You are about to listen to an episode of The Cypher before it was The Cypher. For our first 75 episodes, we were known as Outside the Lines with Rap Genius, and we had a slightly different format. In all honesty, our production value and sound quality today is much improved from these early episodes. That said, the content is so great that these shows are a valuable part of our archive. If you want more information about our transition, make sure to check out episode 76 with Ritz, which was our first one under the new name. To keep up to date on everything involving The Cypher, visit us online at thecyphershow.com or find us on iTunes. And now, without further ado, here's The Cypher before The Cypher.
Rap Genius. I'm not the rapper who thinks he's the best rapper in the world. I don't think everyone's gonna like my music. I actually think my music isn't for everybody.
Straight from the streets of Brooklyn, it's Outside the Lines with Rap Genius.
I'm your host, same old Sean. This week, we're continuing a new feature on Outside the Lines, annotated song excerpts. Every time you hear this sound,
Rap Genius,
go to rapgenius.com and search for Outside the Lines with Rap Genius. The very first result will bring you to annotated excerpts from our interviews that give you behind-the-scenes audio, video, and explanations to bring you further outside the lines. This week on Outside the Lines, we talk to one of our new favorite rappers, Mayhem Loren. Mayhem, along with compatriots like Action Bronson and Rock Marciano, is leading a resurgence of New York City rap. His sense of humor, rhyme style, and unique personality, along with his hysterical ad-libs, have shot him to the top of the rap game in just a handful of years. His projects like Respect the Fly Shit and Mandatory Brunch Meetings have, whatever Pitchfork might say, launched him to the top of our esteem very quickly. We talked to Mayhem at our Rap Genius office in Brooklyn. Same old John, here with Mayhem Loren.
What's good, Lorenovich? We in here.
All right. So, I want to start with, like I said, some kind of lighthearted. You have that line, I've been fly from way back like a pterodactyl. So did you like dinosaurs as a kid?
Yeah, when I was a kid, I was very much into dinosaurs, to be honest. I had a lot of dinosaur books. Used to watch dinosaur cartoons. I was just kind of obsessed with dinosaurs. I was really into that. So, yeah, that's where I got that knowledge. Shout out to all pterodactyls. Rest in peace.
Definitely. Another thing that you did as a kid, I think, was graffiti. At least you talked about it on your record.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, first of all, what was your graph name?
I used to write May, but with an E, just how I spell Mayhem. I actually got the name Mayhem because I used to write May 1, M-E-Y 1, and then that changed into Mayhem when I started rhyming.
Nice. Where'd the M-E-Y come from?
My name is Jamie, J-A-M-E-Y. That's my real name.
Oh.
And I used to date this girl, and, like, she had, like, a funny accent. And she'd say, Jamie, and, like, she turned Jamie into J-May, and, like, I just ran with May, and it's, you know?
Nice.
Shout out to Kimberly. Kimberly used to say my name like that. What up?
Nice. It's all the stories coming out. So what was your, do you ever do that anymore? You ever write anymore?
Honestly, yeah.
Yeah?
Can't get it out of my system. Like, I'll never, like, go on a mission, like, how I used to, like back in the day, graffiti used to be the activity. Like, we'd go out to do graffiti.
Yeah.
Now, I'll do graffiti in between an activity. Like, going from point A to point B, I might write on something. But I'll never just go out on a graph mission now, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Definitely.
Yeah.
It was funny, because in one of your songs, you talk about graffiti as the fever. Right,
yeah.
It seems to be a way of describing it.
Yeah, you got the fever, like, you get the itch, like, sometimes you want to just go write on something. I can't even explain the feeling, it's an addiction, like, you know, I don't drink much, I've never really done any drug, I never smoked a cigarette, but I'm familiar with addiction, because when graffiti's in your blood, it's something that you can't get out.
Yeah. Speaking of addiction, you had a couple lines about this topic, and they really grabbed my attention. You've talked a few times about how you sold cocaine but never used it, and it was because of what you saw when you sold it. Again, I don't know if this is, you know, exaggerated for the song's effect or whatever.
Yeah, that's just rap talk. It's cinematic, you know. I'm playing a role like a guy in a movie. I've never done anything illegal other than graffiti my whole life.
Yeah,
nothing. Matter of fact, I don't even do graffiti. If someone else writes my name for me.
Fair enough. But I thought that was, you know, presumably growing up in Queens, you would have seen the effect that, you know, drugs had on people. And I was just curious, like, what you saw back then that had such a deep effect on you to make you know, write those kinds of things.
Truth be told, I've seen, like, I don't judge anybody for doing anything. As long as you have your life under control, you know, I don't care what you do, as long as you're paying your bills and you're taking care of your kids. And if you want to party, do whatever you want. I don't judge you. But when I see people pick drugs or any addiction over their responsibilities, that's when I see a problem with it. So those are the kind of things I stray away from.
Yeah, definitely.
I got a lot of friends who use drugs, and I love them all.
Definitely. So I have to say, keeping on sort of a similar theme for a while, as someone who takes the dollar van every day, I was curious about the line in Cedar Plank Salmon where you say, take it back to 98 Hammers in the dollar van.
Yeah, I mean, I was just saying, like, when I said that line, I'm kind of like, take it back to 98, like my whole flow, my essence of 1998, like, it was a wild time. And, like, I've seen people actually pull guns out and rob people in the dollar van. Like, the dollar van wasn't always safe in Queens. So I was just kind of saying, yo, I'm taking it back to 98, to that era, the type of music I was listening then, the type of mind state I had then. Like, I'm bringing that to you in 2012, so.
Nice. And what were you listening to back then?
98? Yeah. I was listening to a lot of, I was always listening to Wu. Like, Wu-Tang Forever dropped in 97, so I was listening to Wu-Tang heavy. Listening to CNN, Capone, Noriega, The War Report dropped in 97.
Yeah.
Tragedy, Nas, G-Rap, like, that type of thing.
Yeah, and a lot of those people you mentioned are Queens folks.
Yeah.
Right? And which Queens rap artist do you think you feel kind of closest to, you know, stylistically or an outlook or whatever?
I mean, the one who's inspired me the most, I would have to say, is Kool G Rap. Like, that's my favorite MC. If I had to pick one rapper, that's my favorite rapper. Like, yeah. G Rap, he's just, like, amazing with the wordplay and the flows, you know, the way he tells stories. Like, he's dope. But, I mean, I look up to a lot of people, but I'd have to run with G Rap if I...
Yeah, it's funny. I hear his name over and over again whenever I bring up this stuff, even down to specifics about, like, you know, the first person or one of the first people to rhyme, you know, long words and things like that. So in that tune, Drug Lords, you said something that I thought was really kind of deep and that I wanted to ask about. You said you pen paragraphs for your friends who've kind of struggled with you or who you know and, you know. And I wanted to talk about that, like, can you talk a bit about feeling like you're rapping maybe not just for yourself, but like for your friends, for your community? And like, does that affect what you do, what you rap about?
Yeah, I mean, honestly, it might sound kind of like cliche or selfish, but at the end of the day, when I do my music, the first person that has to be happy with my product is me. Secondly, is my friends. Like, I you know, just like always, you want approval from your friends around the way, people that you came up with. So if I like my music and my friends like the music, I'm happy. If the rest of the world likes the music, I mean, that's great, because that's what I'm trying to do for a career. But I really write for us, or from the perspective of not just myself, but a lot of my friends.
Excellent. That's really great. And so in $1,000 Gym Shoes, that song, maybe just because of how you open it, talking about your dad, like we talked about the last time I saw you. It always seemed like that song maybe was a little special to you or something about it.
Yo, it's just the vibe. Like when Tommy first played me that beat, it kind of had like a, maybe like a old school 70s feel or something that made me want to talk about my father, or I don't know, but it had like a fun vibe to it also. That's why, you know, the hook is kind of playful and it's like $1,000 Gym Shoes. It's like a funny thing to, you know, make a hook about.
Right.
Like, we wear expensive sneakers, but, you know, sometimes it's just like an eccentric thing. I really can't call it. I just have fun with that one.
Rap Genius.
Another thing that's fun is like your outros. I just think they're so funny. Like, just the thing about, you know, looking how you look to your friend's bar mitzvah and the outro where you start reading from books and stuff like that. Is that like, do you write those in advance? Do you just kind of like...
completely off the top of the head. It's never planned. It's kind of like, sometimes at the end of a record, I'll just say things like, it's almost like freestyling, not freestyling in rhyme form, but it's just like I just say whatever, and it usually works. Very rarely do I cut one. And like I said, the one with the books, that was the only time I actually read something for an outro, and that was because I did so many outros on the project. The producer I was working with, my man ATG, shout out to ATG, he's like, yo, you got to do an outro for this, it's the last song. And I said, yo, I've already said anything I could possibly think of. So I just kind of grabbed two random books off his shelf. One was like a Chinese history book, and the other one was some sort of Indian history book. And I just went to random pages, read some things, and we called it a night.
Rap Genius.
It seemed like they cut out the word communist from the first one.
Yeah, yeah, they did, because, you know, you didn't want it to seem like I'm endorsing the Communist Party, or, you know, I just happened to turn the book to that page. I'm not a member of the Communist Party. I'm, you know, capitalist all the way. It just happened.
Yeah. It was just so great, and I think part of what made it work is just how serious you were when reading it.
Yeah, that's what made it funny, because, you know, it seemed like I was really passionate about what I was saying, but I was just reading a random page out of a random book.
Yeah, definitely. That's fantastic. Speaking of the mandatory brunch meetings project, very early on it, I think even in the first song, you have that line about Festivus. Are you a big Seinfeld fan?
I'm a huge Seinfeld fan. Seinfeld and Curb. I actually ended up liking Curb more than Seinfeld as the years went by, but I'm a big Larry David fan, man. Shout out to him. That's like one of my role models.
Excellent. And obviously you talk about food a lot in your rhymes. Do you see any connection between cooking and rapping?
I mean, it's all art. It's all art and creativity. Like, to be honest, like, recently I've been cooking with less salt. And the things that I've been coming up with are great, that, like, sodium replacements, and just there's a million herbs in the kitchen, there's a million herbs and spices, and, you know, it's just all a creative process. Down to the taste of it, to the presentation, it's the same thing with the rhyme, so, you know?
Awesome.
Same part of the brain, I'd say. Same part of the brain works on both.
Mm-hmm. I was talking about Cedar Plank Salmon a minute ago, and there was something else on that song. You shout out the Coliseum Mall there.
Yeah, Jamaica Avenue, Coliseum, like.
What are some of your memories of Coliseum Mall?
I mean, I've been going there my whole life, just buying sneakers, back to school shopping with my mother, going there on my own, watching other kids get their sneakers taken from them. You know, like, now it's a different era. It's a little safer at the Coliseum, like, you know, going with my friends to buy gold fronts there and all types of things, you know?
Yeah. It's, that's amazing. And, you know, you have you've definitely talked about buying sneakers a lot. You have the
I like sneakers. I'm heavily into sneakers, yeah.
Nice. Yeah, you've said it was recreation. If you had, well, first of all, what's your favorite pair of sneakers that you have?
That's a crazy question. I like Air Max 95s. Like, it's not one pair or one color pattern, I could say, but in general, I like 95s a lot. And I like certain Jordans. I like the Jordan 7s a lot. I like Jordans 4 through 7 a lot. So I guess I couldn't even answer that.
Yeah?
I like Barclays, you know. I could go on forever. I can't tell you one pair.
Nice.
I love sneakers.
If you had an unlimited budget, let's say, and one pair of sneakers to get, what would it be?
I'd probably get an unlimited amount of, The Jordan 7, the Bordeaux's, I like those a lot.
Okay, what about them? Just
dope. Yeah. Gray, burgundy, you know. I like them. I have like 5 pair now. If I had an unlimited budget, I would have 50. I would have 100. I'd have 500. Who knows?
Nice. What are you rocking today?
Today, I'm just wearing a pair of Tim's, actually.
Oh, yeah.
It's cold out, classic New York, you know. Keep me warm. You can't go wrong with those.
Yeah, definitely. And you certainly, I assume the statute of limitations is up on this by now, but on Bring the Ruckus, you talk about the sneaker, you know, maybe used to see people boosting sneakers back in the day.
Yeah, honestly, that song is so old, I don't even remember the line. I'm going to be honest. What line was it?
The line was, you say, way back, I used to boost 150 pair of sneakers. So I was just curious, like, without getting into specifics, if you remember tricks that people used to use to get away with boosting sneakers.
You know what? I actually have to hear that song. That might be a misquote because I don't think I said that.
Okay.
I might have mentioned having 150 pair of sneakers, but we never really boosted sneakers. Like,
yeah.
During the boosting era, it was like gear and things like that, but it's crazy. I was never even a big booster. Like, I was more like a schemer. A schemer is different than a booster. Like, I'm the guy who, like, put a $20 price tag on a $1,000 shirt. Like, I wouldn't just steal things. I was never really good at it, and I didn't want to press my luck. You know what I mean?
Right.
But nah, sneakers, I got to listen to that song again because I don't think I boosted sneakers.
Okay.
I said that.
Yeah, yeah. Can you go into that a little more, the difference between a schemer and a booster?
Yeah, I mean, boosters take things, they steal things, and, like, schemers pull off schemes and scams. They might have a traveler's check or a counterfeit bill of some sort, you know. They might do price tags, which is any kind of scheme that's not just actual taking, you know.
Like, yeah.
I mean, it is, at the end of the day, it's still the same thing. It's just a little smoother.
Right.
So I guess I could say I was more smooth during that era. Like, I wasn't, like, the type to just put on a shirt and throw it under my jacket and walk out. Like,
right.
I was the guy to stretch $200 and leave with $3,000 worth of clothes. Like, that was me, you know? But
nice.
That was all a long time ago.
Yeah, yeah. You ever hear, The Coup has a great song about boosters. If you ever heard that.
Who?
The Coup, group out of Oakland. They have a song called I Love Boosters.
Nah, I'm not familiar with that.
Yeah, it's great. It's sort of a tribute to, like, to boosters and resellers and stuff. It's great.
Okay.
Great song. Cool. And I want to talk a little bit about the running stuff. And I feel like Respect the Flyshit in particular was like a big step in some ways for you in terms of like visibility, but also in terms of like, you know, like song concepts and rhyming and things like that. I mean, do you feel that way? Did you feel that way when you were making it? Was
I don't
it just more people noticed it?
Yeah, you know what? There's a lot of things. I don't feel it was a big difference in terms of song concepts, because I actually think previously to that, when I dropped Self-Induced Illness,
yeah.
It was a lot more structured. I had more well-thought-out songs, hooks, things like that.
Yeah.
Respect the Flash, that we did it two days in a hotel room. So it was kind of like rhymes galore, like speed rap kind of. Like, it came out great. I love it. But I don't think it was that structured. I think that it was more visible because it was free, for one. When you give out something for free, you get a lot more attention. Like, when I dropped Self-Induced Illness, people that were already my fans bought it and they loved it. But if you didn't know about me, why would you spend money on me? So this one, I kind of grabbed a lot more fans. Also, the fact that, you know, the whole way it was put together, half the beats were produced by Tommy Mass. He just did the Bronson Lecter album. That was huge. Fraud produced the other half. Fraud was really buzzing a lot at the time. He still is. Shout out to both of them. Bronson's all over it. Bronson was on the rise at the time. And it kind of just, it was perfect. You know, just everyone involved in it and the timing of it got it some light. And since I dropped that, I could say people kind of went back and gravitated a lot more to my older material. So it was a good move.
Excellent. Yeah, and the Self-Induced Illness one, it seemed like there were kind of, that was more in some ways kind of like a, there were more, I never like the word conscious, but more kind of like, almost like serious stuff,
yeah.
Messagey kind of stuff, like almost advice giving in some of the tunes.
Yeah, I mean, that's all me, to be honest. Like, that's kind of like, not to talk about that other site, but
yeah.
When they were saying like, sometimes I'm contradictory, and I mean, sometimes I want to give a message, or sometimes I want to be more positive. Other times I'm just having fun. Other times I'm just talking about a certain era of my life. Whether it was positive or negative, I'm not going to pretend it didn't happen. So, you know, I'm all over the board. But with Self-Induced, it was an album. Like, keep in mind, Respect the Flash, we call that a mixtape. Mandatory Brunch Meetings, I call that a mixtape. Because it was kind of more fun and loose. Like, anytime I drop an album, I will have songs that are more well thought out and conceptual. So,
okay, so it wasn't particularly like a difference in what was going on in your life. It was the kind
yeah,
of project.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, when I drop, like, I'm dropping this album with Mug soon. I'm dropping an album with Buck Wild soon. Like, those are more albums, and you're going to hear concepts on those. I'm dropping one with J Love. So those will be more thought out. When I do a mixtape, it's kind of like, let me just display the rhyme skill and have fun with it.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes the message will be in there, but it doesn't have to be.
Yeah. Speaking of rhyme skill, you use alliteration a lot, and it seems like that's a relatively recent thing. Like, going back to like Clarified Butter or whatever, it wasn't really a part of your style. Like, when did you feel comfortable like kind of using that and bringing that out more?
Just when it makes sense. Just when, you know, like, there's really no pattern or strategy. Just sometimes I'm writing and, you know, alliteration takes over. Other times it doesn't, you know?
Definitely. Talk about that other site for a second. I was just curious, like, I don't want to spend a million years on it.
Nah, it's cool. We can talk about it. I mean, I did a record about him, so
yeah.
I expect, let's talk about
it.
Well,
that's the thing, is like, what was your reaction when you saw the two reviews, and like, what made you take that step from like, oh man, I can't believe they made me that review, to like, I'm going to make a record about this? Like, what pushed you to that?
The fact that when I read the reviews, there were, like, the first review, I kind of just, I took the criticism. I said, you know what? I'm a public figure. Everyone's not going to like everything. Like, and I swear, I can't stress it enough. I'm not the rapper who thinks he's the best rapper in the world. I don't think everyone's going to like my music. I actually think my music isn't for everybody. But the fact that they didn't seem to understand my music is what I had the issue with. If they said, I don't like your music because it's this, this, and that, and that's true, I would have said, fine, that's their opinion, I get it. But if you're going to write like things like, to go back to the Kelly Kapowski song, that the whole song is the metaphor for cocaine, and to say that it was a generic love song and it was poorly written, you obviously didn't understand it. So, you know, you can't bash my product when you don't get it. So when I did the record, it wasn't really, I mean, it was a diss record to an extent, like, in terms of me being disrespectful towards them, because I felt that they were disrespectful towards me in their writing. And it wasn't just like about the music. It seemed like kind of sideways. I almost think it was like personal to an extent. But it was more about clearing up the facts. Like, you didn't understand that this meant this. I'm this guy and I'm this guy. And explaining about my life on why I can be on both sides of the, you know, the spectrum.
Rap genius.
So speaking of both sides, actually, that was one of the things that I wanted to talk to you about. You know, in the Whack Rap song, you talked about, like, it's important to represent both sides of an issue of, you know, your life, of life, of, you know, sort of street life or whatever.
Yeah.
Why do you, both the positive and the negative, like, why do you think that's so crucial? And, like, more importantly, like, what do you think is missing from the music of people who don't show both sides?
I mean, my whole thing is, you don't have to talk about it at all. But if you choose to talk about it, talk about both sides. And that doesn't mean every record, like, sure, you can make a song about selling drugs and getting money and having fun at the strip club because that's real. But don't make 20 songs like that, feed it to the kids, and not make the record about the dude who's in jail right now or the kid who got shot because he chose to live that life. Like, tell both sides of the story. I'm not even saying you have to tell them evenly, but just don't, like, certain artists just completely leave out that aspect of the life. And then it's like, you know, you have young kids listening to this music that think it's all good. It's not all good, like, you know, it's two sides of everything, so just give them both.
Yeah, definitely give some balance there.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. So there was, you have that line, super fly, but I don't believe in superstition. Was that just Slick, or do you actually not consider yourself super? Are there any superstitions you, like, hold to?
There's certain things I do, but I think it's more like OCD than superstition. Like, certain habits I have, but I'm not really superstitious. Yeah, I don't really believe in superstition. Yeah. Or
What are some of the stuff, like mirrors or ladders or anything?
Nah, nothing like that. Like, I can't even think of anything off the top. Like, just certain things that I know I do in given situations. If I think of one, I bring it up later.
Yeah. And when you came in, just kind of went out a little bit. When you first came into the office today, I played you a little bit of Daryl Strawberry's Rap.
That was great.
Yeah, and you do have that line about the 86 Mets. What did that team mean to you when you were growing up? Like, having that championship in Queens, yeah?
I was really young in 86. Like, to be honest, I don't remember them even winning the championship then. Like, I was a kid.
Yeah.
But I know that's the last time they did win a championship. So when I say that line, when I said my driving side of something like the 86 Mets, meaning, like, you know, if you're going to make it to the championship and win, like, you got to have a hell of a drive. And that's, like, the same energy I like to bring with me with anything I do, musically or anything else I put my mind to. So that's all it really was.
Definitely. And you had that line on G.O.D. about how you used to rock Colombian suits with Hilfiger.
Yeah.
What's maybe a fashion choice that you kind of made back then that when you think about it or you see pictures, you're like, man, that really was not a good look?
I mean, the Carl Kanas stuff with, like, the big metal buckles and, like, I don't know why he had big metal plates in the middle of the shirts. And, yo, it was crazy because I remember I had my favorite Carl Kanas shirt and he had, like, a big metal plaque in the middle. And then my mother washed it and the shirt ripped because the metal was so heavy that I guess getting thrown around in the machine, it caused the shirt to tear. And, like, those are just crazy now when I look back, but at the time it was hot, you know.
Rap genius.
Definitely. And obviously you've been you're repping Polo, you know, hard.
Yeah, you know, I just found something I like and kind of stuck with it. It's not the only brand I wear, but it's definitely the favorite. It's, like, you know, 90% of my wardrobe.
Yeah. And so I guess I was curious what it was like to kind of be, you know, adopted and brought into the circle of some of the original low heads, you know, a bit after the fact. They're a little older than you and you kind of join them. You just started hanging out with them with sort of late 90s, right? Somewhere around there?
Yeah, I guess mid to late 90s, yeah. You know,
what was it like to kind of meet and be brought into that circle?
I mean, I didn't think much about it. Like, you know, I was cool with a lot of older dudes anyway, just from graffiti and being outside in New York running around. So it was kind of like we just had a mutual interest. And it was like a lot of them, like, they would tell me back then, like, oh, shorty, you remind me of me back in the day, like when I was your age. And it was kind of like, all right, no doubt. And we just became friends. And the rest is history.
Excellent. Yeah, you've worked, obviously, with at least the preeminent rapping lowhead, Thurston Howell.
Yeah, that's my man. Thurst is like family. That's like a big brother. Like, you know, that's my man.
What did you learn from him, both like career-wise and rapping-wise?
I learned how far you could go really independently and doing everything yourself. Like, I mean, Thurston sold thousands of records. And I've seen him press these records himself, package them, like, really. When I say do it yourself, I mean do it with no help. Like, book his own shows. I mean, just going far. Made a living off rap. He may not be a rap superstar or rich off rap, but Thurston Howell hasn't worked a job in years. And even to this day, you know, he might not be in the limelight all the time, but he's made a career out of rap and did it himself. And that was kind of inspirational, you know?
Yeah, definitely. And I think he's also gone really far with, like, creating a personality.
Yeah.
And a character on his records. You kind of feel like, I only met him briefly. I don't know much what he's like in real life. But listening to his records, you feel like, oh, okay, I know this dude.
Yeah. Nah, he's a good dude. And something else I learned from him is that if you're going to be in a certain field, to learn the whole field. Like, Thurst, not only does he rap, like, he makes beats. He's an engineer. He mixes and masters things. He directs videos. Like, he really learned the whole business. And that's why even if the day comes when he decides not to rap, he has a film studio in Florida. He has a recording studio. And he's kind of just learned a lot of things about the game. And I appreciate that a lot. Like, you know?
Nice. You see yourself going in that direction? I mean, you're working with a lot of talented producers all the time.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not even thinking about that right now. To be honest, I'm just trying to focus on the rhymes and the music. But, I mean, down the line, why not, you know?
Yeah. Speaking of talented producers, you know, when I first met you, you were in the studio with Mutz. How's that project going?
That project is incredible. It might actually be my best work to date, to be honest. Like, I really, really like the project. The beats are really top-notch. We made a lot of them from scratch. Like, he would bring sound samples, drum kits into the studio, ask me what I like, and we'd build on the beats together. So I've never done that with any producer. So, like, it's really, I have exactly what I want from Muggs. And it's just coming out dope. It's an honor to work with him. Like, Cypress Hill, the first Cypress Hill album is, like, my favorite album of all time. It's funny because I was talking to you and you asked me who my favorite rapper was, and I said G-Rap. But then if you would ask me what my favorite album was, I would have told you the first Cypress Hill album, because just the production, the overall sound and feel of it, like, I love that album. I listen to it once a week since I've been, like, 10 years old. Like, you know, that album's a part of me.
That's incredible. And then to work with the guy who created it.
Yeah, it's funny how things work.
Yeah.
And then he's just real cool, down to earth. He's a great dude.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and I wanted to ask you a little bit about how you write, because I saw the studio, you know, he was kind of playing beats and you would sort of nod and what seemed like working out at least beginning lyrical ideas, you know, sort of under your breath. Is that, how did you write, John?
The way that I write is, it's kind of like I write the first line, and then I just keep saying that line over and over again until I come up with the second line. Then I'll say those two lines over and over again until I come up with the third. Then I'll say the third, and I keep going. But I write like that because I want everything to flow smoothly and fit into place. So usually by the time I finish writing a verse, I have it memorized because I've been reciting it so many times to get to the end of it. So that's my writing process.
That sounds so great, because I feel like one of the big problems with a lot of artists is, like, they'll have a bunch of hot lines, but you can kind of tell, oh,
that
they're
pieced together
from here, or four bars from this other page in their book or whatever.
And I did that early in my career, and, like, I saw flaws in that, so that's why I started writing, to make sure that everything just kind of flows together. Like, that's what I do.
Awesome. Cool. Well, can you give us kind of a rundown? You gave us a little bit of a rundown of what you have, so what irons in the fire you have now, like what you're working on.
Well, right now I'm working on a full project with Buck Wild, full project with Muggs, full project with J Love, and a full project with Harry Fraud. So
four albums.
Four albums.
More,
I mean,
time to release that than it'll take you to make.
Yeah, I mean, I don't expect them all to drop this year, but those are the things that I'm working on, and you know?
Yeah. And I wanted to ask one more thing about your influences. I read this really great interview with you. You talked about the artists you see as real legends are people who have both flow and manage to say something.
Yeah.
That people, you know, great artists, but, you know, people fall on both sides of that. They have one, but not necessarily the other. And they're
exactly.
Wonderful. Who do you view as having bridged those two sides?
Dude, like Nas. Definitely, like, Nas always says something great that makes sense, and his flow is always, you know, on point. Dude, like, Tragedy, Ghostface, you know? Like, those dudes, they always say something incredible and or meaningful, and the flow is still dope. Like, a lot of people have great flows. They just slap words together, and it sounds great, but then when you really analyze it, they're not saying anything. Then a lot of people have, like, deep messages and things that need to be said, but you're not even going to get to the end of the song because there's no flow with it. So it's like, you don't want to just hear a lecture. You know what I mean? So,
yeah. Awesome. And real quick, you have this phrase on your song, Drug Lords, that I thought was such a great phrase. It's intricate thug rap. And I was wondering if you can kind of break that down a little for me. Did you come up with that? Like, where the...
Yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah. I mean, it's just kind of, you know, detailed, complex, but it's still like thug shit. Like, you know what I mean? Like, I guess that's kind of the category of MC that I fall into, because I don't consider myself to be just a thug rapper that just not saying anything intellectual, just like, you know, I'll fuck you up, I'll shoot you, blah, blah, blah. Like, it's deeper than that. So it's kind of like intricate thug raps, apply it often. Like, that's what I do. That's what I bring to the table.
Excellent. And what? And so, what's going on with the
outdoorsman? I mean, a lot of people are working. There's just a lot of people working on solo endeavors right now, and maybe one day we'll get everyone in a room together to do a group project. I don't know, but you're gonna see a lot of, you know, we're all active. So, you know, J Love is still doing the mixtapes. He's doing his rhyme thing. He's doing production for several people. Action is running around the planet right now. I'm working on numerous things, like I just said. Corin is about to drop a project. My brother Hologram's working on something. Science is about to drop a project. And the other members, I guess eventually they'll start doing things. If not, they'll be featured on our stuff. So it's like...
Who else is part of the crew?
Yeah, well, the original outdoorsman was me, J-Love, Corin, Hologram, who went by the name Jay Steele originally.
Mm-hmm.
Animal, Take It, who's J-Love's younger brother. Prince Original, that's Jay Love's man. I mean, he's cool with all of us, but, like, Jay brought him to the table. Action Bronson. And Killer Shah, rest in peace. Killer Shah passed away, but he was a member, too.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, happens. Yeah. No.
Yeah. So, Jay Steele is your actual brother?
Yeah, it's my brother. Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Physical. 2 years younger, same parents.
Nice. Well, I look forward to hearing all the stuff. And thanks so much for coming by, man.
Thanks for having me.
That was our talk with Mayhem Loren. To hear more of his verified Rap Genius explanations about his own songs, visit rapgenius.com/Mayhem Loren. If you've enjoyed Outside the Lines, make sure to visit us on iTunes, where you can subscribe so you never miss an episode. While you're there, give us a review. The more reviews we get, the better chance we have to keep bringing you quality guests like Mayhem Loren. Outside the Lines with Rap Genius is created and written by Sean Sotaro, a.k.a. Same Old Sean.
I just say whatever and it usually works.
The show is produced and engineered by Josh Cross at Crosstown Studios.
Completely off the top of the head. It's never planned.
Our music is by Psionic.
The whole song is the metaphor for cocaine.
This interview was recorded by Tommy Fisher.
You can't bash my product when you don't get it.
Our show's intern is Sonny Kahara.
Very rarely do I cut one.
And the webmaster of the upcoming OutsideTheLinesPodcast.com is Paul Dice.
No, listen, I say things and I'm going to get asked questions about them. That's cool. I mean, that's fine.
Join us next week on Outside the Lines when we talk to A&R man, producer, and all-around Renaissance guy, Dante Ross.
We can always cut stuff out. That's what I pay my producer for.
Yeah, got it.